advisors for inviting me. Despite the fact that my topic will be a little bit different than the topics of the talks which we have heard here, because I will talk about quantum mechanics, and as you will see, the main complication of our problem really comes from the fact that the underlying first principle model is quantum mechanical. Okay. So it's a joint work with Manfred Samhofer and Hongqian Yao. Let me start with a basic model, which I'm going to investigate and I'm trying to show eventually quantum diffusion. So the basic model has two names, depending on which community you are coming from. You can call it quantum Lorentz gas, or you can call it the Anderson model. These are basically the same things. These are random Schrödinger operators, they're usually Schrödinger operators with random potentials. So the quantum Lorentz gas name is usually used in the time-dependent setup. You take the Hamiltonian, just the usual Laplacian for the kinetic energy, plus a random potential. The randomness will be specified a little bit later. And I put in a small coupling parameter lambda because I want to play with it. And then simply I would like to solve this Schrödinger equation, especially for a long time. So this describes an electron moving in a random environment, a random potential environment, and that's where the name quantum Lorentz gas comes from. Well, we have heard already yesterday the classical Lorentz gas, at least the periodic Lorentz gas. This is its quantum version, but now the randomness will not be the potential will not be periodic. Now, the other name for that is the famous Anderson model. That was originally on ZD instead of RD, and I will continue to talk about the ZD model, although there is not much difference between the RD and ZD. There is no ultraviolet problem in this whole game. But traditionally, Anderson introduced this on ZD, which means that simply discretize the Laplacian in the usual way. And then the random potential fields, if you are on ZD, then it's somewhat easier to define what it means randomness. So you simply take V of X, which is a random variable attached to every lattice point of ZD. These are independent, identical, distributed, appropriate, normalized random variables. And now let me go back to the original question. You would like to solve the Schrödinger equation for a long time. You would like to see how the particle moves in this random environment. Now, of course, the free Schrödinger equation is ballistic if there is no random potential at all. Now, the mean squared displacement defined as the expectation value of x squared is t squared, which is, of course, the typical signature of a ballistic motion. So it's like a wave equation, and it's very, very different from the heat equation, which has the diffusive scaling. And as our final theorem will state, is that under appropriate limiting procedure, which I'm going to explain precisely, our final theorem will state that if you turn on the potential, you turn on this random magnetic field instead of the random potential instead of the zero potential, then this behavior, this ballistic behavior, will change into a diffusive behavior, different according to a diffusive scaling. So it will be described by a heat equation, heat type equation. Yeah. No, it's independent, so completely uncorrelated. Discrete lattice, and at every point you have a random variable, which are identically distributed, but they are independent.
And will
there
be some scaling?
Yeah, there will be scaling, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. So now let me just advertise a little bit the Anderson model, because this may not be so well known in this community. This is one of the most investigated models in mathematical physics, because there are few things which are quite a lot of things which are known about the Anderson model and can be rigorously justified mathematically, and there are quite a lot of things which cannot be, or we don't know how to do them. So it's a good playground for mathematics.
T is
the time variable. So this is a time-dependent equation, so psi sub t is the solution at time t, and I didn't put in the x variable. There should be an x variable as well. So I just try to indicate it's a time-dependent problem. Okay, so now the basic results or basic questions about the Anderson models can be summarized in the following way. You can either look at the time-dependent setup, or you can look at it from a spectral point of view. These are basically the same. And what you see is that there is a dichotomy. Namely, if you look at the long-time behavior, then it can happen that either the evolution has localized states, which means that you start from a localized data, from a while the state may disperse a little bit, but then after a while the dispersion stops and the state roughly remains in the same volume. That's what localized state means. And spectrally it corresponds to the fact that the Hamiltonian, a time-independent Hamiltonian, has pure point spectrum. Or the other possibility, which can happen with this model, is that you have extended states, which means that the eigenfunctions, which have a continuous spectrum, eigenfunctions are delocalized. Or if you start with even a localized state, after a long time, the state simply disappears like a plane wave. Now, so there is this dichotomy, and the first statement, the localized state, which spectrally means pure point, the first scenario has been proven in many, many different works and under many, many different conditions. Here I just mentioned the two or three most important ones. First of all, in one dimension, all eigenfunctions are localized for all randomness, non-zero randomness. So if you turn on in one dimension, if you turn a little bit randomness, whatever small randomness it is, the ballistic behavior completely changes, which was shown in previously, the ballistic behavior of the free Schrödinger equation, completely changes, and all states are localized. It's quite surprising. Now, in higher dimensions, the situation is somewhat different. There, the localization occurs for large lambda, for large disorder, or near the band edge. Let me not explain what it means exactly. This is related to the underlying periodic, when the free Hamiltonian is replaced by a periodic background potential. So in that case, you have localization, at least in the regime when the potential dominates, the large lambda regime. This has been proven by Fleury-Spencer and later different too by Eisenman, Molchanov, and then many, many people worked on various related models. Now, basically, from mathematical point of view, the localized regime is fairly well understood, and the other regime is absolutely not understood, namely the extended state regime. So here are three open conjectures. They are sort of related. The first one is in three or higher dimensions, the small lambda regime. So you have a random Schrödinger operator with small but non-zero coupling. And then you would like to show that the spectrum is absolutely continuous, or you may want to show that if you inspect the time evolution, then the long time evolution means that the state just spreads out. This is not known, this is not proven. What is known is that if you do it on the beta lattice, which corresponds to the infinite dimensional case, higher dimension, the problem is easier, then it's known by Albert Klein. And recently there was a paper by Burgen who considered the situation when the potential is not homogeneous, rather it has a decay, it has a fairly fast decay, like 1 over x faster decay. And in that case, you can also prove it. But this is the situation when the typical number of collisions is finite. So you start your particle near the origin, and you have an environment where the potential decays fairly quickly out of infinity. So your particle, of course, starts moving outwards, starts colliding. But since the potential is so weak outside, after a finite number of collisions, typically it doesn't collide anymore and just flies out freely. So this is in that case, it's also known that the spectrum is absolutely continuous. This is one question. The second question is the remaining dimension, d equal 2, which is not known either. It's suspected that all eigenfunctions are localized for all lambda, but probably the localization length is extremely big. It's exponentially big in lambda, and it's very, very hard to say anything rigorously about that. And the third conjecture which is sort of the closest to my talk, is the quantum Brownian motion conjecture, which basically says what I advertised earlier, that at least in higher, three or higher dimensions and small lambda, the location of the electron is governed by the heat equation. It's not a, it's not a ballistic equation like in the lambda equals zero, the free case, but by the heat equation. I will state a more precise theorem later on, but this quotation mark indicates that roughly the probability density of the electron satisfies some kind of heat equation, which in particular means that the scale, the mean square displacement scales like T and not like T square. Now, our main result is not that one. That would be too much. By the way, the quantum Brownian motion conjecture is even stronger than the famous extended states conjecture, so we cannot prove that. But what we can prove, we can do it up to a certain time scale. You see, when you try to prove extended states, you try to prove a statement about absolute continuous spectrum, for example, that means that you have to see the evolution. If you try to do it in a time-dependent manner, you have to follow the evolution up to infinite time. Because what you are fighting against is that maybe something happens after a very, very long time scale. This is probably what happens in two dimensions. Two-dimensional evolution for a very long time looks like diffusive, but then after an exponentially long time, it stops diffusing anymore. So whenever you try to prove extended states, you have to prove something for infinite time. That's too hard. We cannot do that. What we can do is that we can do it up to a certain time scale, and now we will choose small lambda, coupling constant is small, and the time scale, the long time scale, is given as an inverse power, a certain inverse power of this small coupling parameter. And in this way, we will be able to prove this statement. But this will be on the lattice. But as I said, our proof is on the lattice, but we can do it on the continuum as well. It's not really it's not a short scale problem, it's a long scale problem. Large scale problem. I will come to that. It's IID. So. It's the force moments have to be bounded. Now, let me just compare it with this Burgens result. In our case, the typical number of collision is lambda squared times T. This is a typical weak coupling scaling for the number of collisions, and especially in our scaling where kappa is a positive number, not too big, but it's a positive number. In our case, the typical number of collisions also goes to infinity, in contrast to Burgens' result, where the typical number of collisions is finite. Okay. Yeah, this is the Burgens' result. That's where the potential falls off. Then you can also count the number of collisions. This one is for the homogeneous case. So you have random potential equal size everywhere. That's the real case. I mean, you do this decaying case because that's what you can do mathematically. But of course, the true model is the model which I introduced. That's where it's really identically distributed random variables. So the variance is the same everywhere. It's a homogeneous environment. Okay. So now let me just introduce very quickly the Wigner distribution, although I think in this community this is very well known. Since we would like to express something on large scale, and we would like to compare the quantum mechanics with some kind of kinetic equation, it's good to translate the quantum mechanical wave function psi into a phase space density, so the Wigner distribution comes in hand. And I think everybody knows its properties, so let me not go through it. Now, since we will do a large time behavior, we will investigate the problem on large time, we will have to rescale appropriately the Wigner transform, or the phase space density. The rescaling parameter will be epsilon, and that will be chosen according to the time scale so that you see something non-trivial. Now, in the weak coupling limit, which is the simplest situation, which you can do in this setup, you choose epsilon to be lambda square. That turns out to be the right scaling, and you rescale space and time appropriately. So I introduce this capital T, capital X parameters for the macroscopic variables. This is the kinetic scaling, which means that the velocity is unscaled. I scale the time and the space in the same way, And F sine equals lambda square happens to be the right scaling if you do a little back-of-the-envelope calculation. That's the scaling when you see something. So here is our first result. This is an old result, but it comes into to the argument, so let me just show it. So this is the Boltzmann, the derivation of the Boltzmann equation from this quantum mechanical model from the random Schrödinger equation. The Boltzmann equation is a kinetic limit, which says the following, that you choose F sine, you choose the space scaling as lambda square, and then you do the following thing. Let me start reading this formula from here. You take the solution of the Schrödinger problem psi up to a long time, p over epsilon, up to a time scale, which is 1 over epsilon. So you get a wave function, it's a random wave function, a Wolf wave function in this random environment. You translate it into a phase space density by the Wigner transform. You rescale it, this little epsilon, you rescale it appropriately because after a long time scale, the wave function is spread out, so you want to rescale it to an order one scale. Epsilon is chosen appropriately. You get a Wigner function, which is still a random object. You take its expected value, and the claim is that this function, which is a function in the phase space, converges weakly to a function, ftxv, and the time-dependent function in the phase space, which satisfies the linear Boltzmann equation written here. The linear Boltzmann equation has two data in it. One of them is the EV, which is just the dispersion relation. Typically, it's V square if it were the continuous model, but in the discrete model, it's somewhat different to the sum of the cosines. And the other data is the collision kernel sigma, which is just tells you the rate of the collision if you have an incoming velocity u and an outgoing velocity v. And from the statistics of our random potential, we can explicitly compute this sigma. I didn't write up the result, but we can explicitly compute it from microscopic dynamics. Now, the first result of the microscopic data, the first result of this type was due to Spohn for short time, short macroscopic time, and later we generalized it with Yau for a long time. And then there was a work about the discrete model as well. Our original model was in continuum. And then I did another work about the phonon model when instead of random potentials, instead of random potential, you take an electron in a phonon gas, which can be viewed as interacting bosons, which can be viewed as not a frozen random environment, but a dynamical random environment. Yeah? E is the dispersion relation. So this is, as I said, in continuum it's V squared. In discrete case, it's the sum of the cosines. Yeah, true. And the sigma depends on the explicit model. I mean, it depends on the randomness, statistics of the randomness. Most importantly, sigma contains the so-called on-shell condition. So it's a function, it's rather a distribution, which is concentrated on the energy shell. The energy of the incoming and the outgoing velocities have to be the same. So it contains a delta function of EV minus EU. Okay, so here's a little picture showing what's going on. So it's the picture on the right side of the right hand side shows the microscopic scale. It's a bit schematic. So it's on a scale which is comparable to the wavelength of the particle. And here this big black object is just an obstacle. So an incoming wave. After the collision, it can go into many, many different directions. It's a bit schematic picture. It seems that you have just one single outgoing direction. But, of course, what happens in a true collision, that after the collision, the wave is split into a huge superposition of elementary waves. So it could go out in this direction, every possible direction. Okay? So this corresponds to the Schrödinger equation. Now, our claim is that our theorem asked how this evolution behaves on the large time scale. So you take a large time scale lambda to the minus 2. You also rescale the space. It happens to be the kinetic scaling which gives you the non-trivial result. And then you see a picture like that. It's a multiple collision process. multiple scattering process. But let me again emphasize that this black line here is just one possible trajectory. At every collision, there could be many, many directions, many, many outgoing directions. So eventually, you will have to sum up many, many possible elementary paths. And a picture like that corresponds to the Boltzmann equation. Now, also there's a little cheating. This black dot is a real obstacle. This black dot is not a real obstacle. This is a phenomenological obstacle corresponding to the Markovian picture of the Boltzmann equation. Now, let me also emphasize this is not a semi-classical model, which is manifested in the fact that the wavelength of the incoming wave is comparable with the size of the obstacle. That in the semi-classical model, the wavelength is much, much shorter. Okay? So now let me come to the new result, which is the same statement on a longer time scale. You would like to do the same evolution, investigate the same problem, but on a longer time scale. So we do the following. We take a kappa, which is a positive number. We cannot go beyond 1 over 50, but that's a technical issue. And what we do is that we go, I don't know if it's strong enough, we go on a timescale which is even longer than our previous timescale. The kinetic timescale was lambda minus 2 times the macroscopic time t, and now we go to an even longer timescale by a factor of lambda minus kappa. Appropriately, we will have to, it turns out, it's not just an ansatz, it turns out that that's the right scaling, we have to rescale the space in the following manner. The lambda minus 2x is the kinetic space scaling that was there on the Boltzmann picture. And now in the additional lambda minus kappa time corresponds to an additional lambda minus kappa over 2 rescaling in space. So there you see the diffusive scale at top of the lambda minus 2 kinetic scale. Okay? And now the statement is basically what you expect. The following, you take the evolution up to this longer time scale, lambda minus 2 minus kappa time scale. You again take the Wigner distribution, you take its expected value. Now, on this longer time scale, you do not expect to trace the velocity anymore, as the Brownian motion has no velocity anymore. So what we can do is that we can take the marginal, integrate out the velocity. Turns out that we have to integrate out velocities only on a fixed energy shell. And then it converges to a function, which is now a function in position and in energy space. Again, weak convergence, and this function satisfies the heat equation, where the diffusion coefficient, I didn't write up explicitly, is again easily computable from the model. Okay, now of course it's a weak limit, which was also a characteristic of the Boltzmann equation. In particular, only macroscopic observables can be controlled. So the weak limit, of course, means that if you take an observable in the C0 infinity observable in the macroscopic coordinate and test it, then you get this limit. You are not allowed to test this problem on a microscopic scale. So the moral of the story is that the particle in the random media converges to the Brownian motion. Yes? You mean how it scales with E or... No, it's basically the expected value of the gradient of the EV. So I think it's, I'm not sure if I will be able to write it up explicitly. So you take the gradient, it's IJ, you take the gradient E, and then you average over the surface. So it's that quantity. Yes. Boltzmann equation. Yeah. That's right. So maybe I should have said. So actually, this is in the coming picture. That's right. So you see. Well, we didn't consider the. I mean, in the yes, it's true. Yeah. So it's in the discrete case, of course, you have the minus 2d, 2d Laplacian, and we can do it at the band edge as well. Yeah. Well, there is a normalization here. So, I mean, depending, you have to define it properly. And eventually, dE, I think it behaves like square root of E at the bend edge. So you see something, you see an effect at the bend edge. But the analysis is very... Okay. What? E of E is just the usual summation minus cosine VI, three-dimensional diffusion dispersion relation. Okay, so now let me come back to this picture and then say something where does this come from. So of course what we do is that these first two pictures is the Boltzmann picture, now we go into an even longer time space, we zoom it out once more, again with a factor of lambda minus 2. You see, typically, when you rescale this Boltzmann picture, you see the random, the Boltzmann is like a random walk, and then you see the Brownian motion picture, which corresponds to the heat equation. Now, what we did is that you can start with the Schrödinger equation, you rescale it up to lambda minus 2, you get the Boltzmann equation, and if you rescale it for even longer time scale, then you get the heat equation. And in particular, the diffusion coefficient over there, it can be easily computed, at least naively, it's not a proof, but you can compute it from the Boltzmann equation directly. The Boltzmann equation of diffusion has a collision kernel. You can rescale it. It's like a random walk. You can rescale it, and you can compute in the back of the envelope of your diffusion coefficient. And what you get there is exactly what you expect from the Boltzmann equation. However, let me emphasize that if you do it in these two steps, then you are cheating. You see, what you can do is that, of course, you might say that going from Schrödinger to Boltzmann, that was our older paper in the quantum kinetic limit. And then going from Boltzmann to heat equation, at Boltzmann level, there is no physical obstacle anymore. It's a phenomenological model, a Markov process. And that was already done by Wiener, basically, how to get Brownian motion from random walk. So it seems that these two steps, once the first step is done, getting rid of the obstacles and quantum mechanics, you can do the second step easily. But of course, this requires a two-step limiting argument, which is not the same, or not necessarily the same, as doing the honest thing, namely starting from the Schrödinger evolution and do the quantum diffusive limit, which means that you evolve the Schrödinger equation, the true quantum mechanics, up to the time scale you are interested in. Because what could happen if you don't do that in this way, what could happen is that it may be that certain quantum correlations, which are negligible on this first time scale, and they are neglected in this first limit, may become important, may become relevant in the next time scale. And probably actually that's what happens in two dimensions. That's why the two-dimensional picture, two-dimensional random walk, two-dimensional random Schrödinger operator stops being diffusive and then becomes localized.
Let me ask a question. The first time you're going from Schrödinger to Boltzmann, this limit is only a short time result, or is it a quarter-one time result?
This is a long time. This is for any time, any fixed time.
Not uniform in length.
And then, of course, the second one is also for any time on that time scale. So it's always. Okay. Yeah? There is no real Wigner equation. This is we don't work in this language. I mean, if you wish that the Boltzmann equation can be viewed as a Wigner equation, I don't know if that. You see, from our point of view, we don't do Wigner equation at all. We don't translate Schrödinger equation into Wigner equation. We use Wigner transform as a tool to express the result. So at the end, when I state the theorem, you have the wave function evolves according to Schrödinger equation, and then you try to translate it into something which lives on phase space density. So the Wigner transform is an appropriate tool to do that, but we don't use any Wigner equation. Yeah?
Phases, the wave function, there is destructive interference.
get diffusive like behavior. Can you see Fourier formulation?
Yeah, that's exactly how we
present the same kind of result.
Yeah, that's exactly how we prove it. This corresponds to the this is part of our proof that you have to show that the various elementary wave function elementary waves cancel each other. Okay, so since my time is getting up, let me rest a little bit. So the remarks are the following at the conclusions of the theorem is that although I said that it's important to do this honest limiting procedure, so one limit, doing everything up to the long time scale, not two scale limits, of course eventually our finding says that the quantum interferences are irrelevant up to our time scale. If it were not like that, then you would not be able to compute this diffusion coefficient from Boltzmann equation. Actually, what is expected is that if you go for longer time scale, we can do it only up to this kappa 1 over 50, if you go to a time scale which corresponds to lambda equal 2, then you start seeing some correction to this diffusion coefficient, starts depending on the dimension. Now, also that's what's written basically here. Now, let me also emphasize that even the classical version of this theorem is not proven. So you can ask the same question, you can ask the classical Lorentz gas, random potential, Poisson obstacles, or whatever, and you try to do it up to a time scale when you have typically infinitely many collisions beyond the kinetic time scale, and you don't know. There is no theorem of the corresponding classical mechanics. Now, you might not like the fact that I had to take the expectation of the Wigner transform, but this is not serious. One can do it in a stronger sense. One can do it in variance norm and so on. So I think my time is up. I cannot really say much about the proof. But let me just say that basically our proof is a huge classification of Feynman graphs. So let me just flash this up. One does analysis on this object, on objects like that. Let me not introduce what these graphs mean. Each of these graphs correspond to an interference between two elementary waves. You have, as I showed in the picture, every elementary wave corresponds to a sequence of collisions. That's this dots represent the sequence of collisions. And since you have computed the Wigner transform, which is a quadratic object in psi, you have to take another copy of all these elementary wave functions. So you have to take two elementary wave functions with their own collision histories, and you have to compute their contribution to the expected value of the Wigner transform. Due to the expectation, due to some weak theorem, you have to take a sort of so-called pairing, which means that you have to take all possible pairing of these two collision histories, and then you have to compute this contribution. The typical contribution looks like a horrible integral of this type. It means it looks much shorter because it's a huge product. The horrible integral of singularities, omega is basically the renormalized dispersion relation. So it's like, think of it like p squared. So all of these denominators have huge singularity set. They have a singularity set on a surface. And on top of that, you have a huge delta function which enforces momentum conservation between the P and the Q momenta. And you have to evaluate such a horrible singular integral in a very high dimensional phase space when the singularities may be enhanced by the delta functions, the extra delta functions. This is my last slide and our technical result, which is probably interesting for people working with Feynman graphs. What we can do is that when we compute the value of a Feynman graph like that, we can gain an extra lambda factor per so-called non-ladder vertices. This sounds a little bit technical, but every Feynman graph corresponds to a permutation according to how you pair these things. You can draw the permutation as the graph of the permutation as a function, and ladders, we call ladders, these consecutive sequences like that. And now, You see, the degree of the permutation is the number of non-ladder indices. It turns out that these consecutive sequence of points correspond to the give you order one contribution, and whenever this nice sequence is broken, so you see something else, then that corresponds to a phase interference, like you said, and that should make the size of this horrible integral smaller. Now, how much smaller? You would like to gain a lambda factor, many, many lambda factors, actually, and what we can prove is that you can gain one lambda factor per non-ladder vertex. And that's the main technical tool to do the Feynman perturbation expansion and sum up all diagrams in a rigorous way. Okay, thanks.